And so I'm glad that KBOO is a different kind of workplace, and that's what I want to be, and that's what I support, and I hope that you support it as well. And as I've mentioned before, the membership drive is coming up. Human activities like burning coal, oil, and natural gas and destroying rainforests are pumping greenhouse gases into the atmosphere at an unprecedented rate. Maria Gallucci, writing in IBTimes.com, says from 2000 to 2010, total man-made emissions reached the highest levels in human history, hitting about 49 gigatons of carbon dioxide equivalent in 2010. According to the latest report by the UN's intergovernmental, say that three times quickly, panel on climate change, we just had the hottest August in history on this planet. Returning to the article, more recent data showed global carbon dioxide emissions from burning fossil fuels rose about 3% between 2010 and 2011. When all those emissions enter the atmosphere, they act like a force field. Land and water reflect the sun's rays, but instead of shooting off into space, they come back to Earth, warming up the ground and sea. This is the basic science of climate change. As a result, the global average temperature of land and oceans rose by roughly 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit. From 1880 to 2012, this year alone, three of the past 8 months, May, June, and August, were the hottest on record, and 2014 is poised to be the world's warmest year since record-keeping began. A warmer world is translating into higher sea levels for three key reasons: melting glaciers, melting polar ice caps, ice loss from Greenland, and from West Antarctica, and expanding water. When water heats up, it occupies more space. That's funny to me. When I do this show, and I spend about 10 hours a week working on things that specifically have to do with this program, but I do the aggregation, the script, that sort of thing, at the last minute, and I get off work at pretty close to 2 a.m., and then I come in here, and my brain does those little things, like I try to say the word water, and the word article comes out. And that's just the way it's going to be. I do enjoy doing this so much, and I'm so grateful to KBOO and to the KBOO members for allowing this to happen all these years. Returning to the article by Maria Gallucci, in the past century, the mean sea level has risen by as much as 8 inches. In the past 20 years, the annual rate of rise has been 0.3 of an inch per year, roughly twice the average speed of the preceding 80 years. Climate change is already affecting food production on land and sea, and the problem will only intensify. A combination of higher temperatures, persistent drought, and scarcer rainfall is slowing the rate of increase in crop yields. Production of wheat, a particularly sensitive crop, could drop by 2% a decade in certain parts of the world. Changing ocean temperatures could similarly slam fish populations, reducing catches 40 to 60%. All aspects of food security are potentially affected by climate change, according to the report, warning of famine, possible food wars as supplies become harder to secure. This is the sort of thing I'm talking about when I say of a war, of Ebola, of the solar blast that we'll eventually suffer from. And climate change. Climate change is the thing that we are dealing with now. She writes, asthma attacks worsen as ozone levels increase. Lung and heart illnesses could rise because of more frequent wildfires. Pests like ticks and mosquitoes will multiply, spreading their vector-borne diseases. Allergies will increase as pollen flourishes, and flooding-related hazards will occur more often as rainfall levels rise. More on that article, of course, but I think you get the point. Number to call with your comments or questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187, and Elliot is on the air.
Yes, well, I'm going to say some brief, politically incorrect things about KBOO and about Naomi Klein, so I'll start by saying something politically correct. As far as climate change and the recent New York rally, which I'm sad that I missed because I was on the staff of the 1 million person anti-nuke rally in 82, which was the most recent predecessor. If this country had any leadership, people with more backbone than Obama or even greater corporate criminal Holder, we could shift from a permanent war economy into spending large New Deal type spending on rooftop, both residential and commercial solar, and to back it up, depending upon what part of the country you live in to back it up with rooftop individual wind or geothermal. And
you know, that could have a couple of benefits. I mean, for one thing, if you produce your electricity on your own rooftop, you're not incurring transmission costs.
Exactly. You're not incurring the losses, and you're with the feed-in tariff, it's accelerates it paying for itself, and the feed-in tariff, which for the layman means that when you run your meter backwards, the electric company has to pay you. That's what has made it such a success in Germany. And if we had more rational people in this country, that instead of building the 10,000th tank that we don't need just to provide jobs, we could build the 100,000th solar panel that we do need.
I'm with you so far.
I'll make my politically incorrect comments.
All right, fire away.
It's a pure coincidence. I'm a New Yorker. I have watched the gradual and continuing approach of the final bankruptcy of the KABU of New York, WBAI, which will be followed by the bankruptcy of the Pacifica affiliate in Washington, which was largely caused by sclerotic lack of change and cronyism at those stations. And, you know, it's very noticeable to me. It's purely a coincidence, but the program before yours, which, you know, has been the same program before yours for many years, lady takes a month off, and instead of bringing in any one of a large number of the programmers trained to do the evening news on the supposed training program and let them try out a new show, an old programmer who supposedly retired is brought right back in to fill in. I call it seat warming, because I got used to huge numbers of examples of seat warming that went on at WBAI all the time.
You know, I just don't think it's comparable. I mean, for one thing, Lisa Loving, the specific example you're referring to, is an increasingly dynamic and present journalist here in Portland.
I'm talking about the lack of opportunity for the programmers trained to do the afternoon news. And the fact that just as a complete coincidence, when your personal partner, everybody's entitled to a vacation, takes off a full month prior to this, instead of allowing any of those newly trained programmers to try out a new show or a new concept in the summer, you let one of your other 10 to 20 year veteran programmers, many of whom are retirees, just seat warm the seat instead of allowing anybody who is newly trained to try out a new show.
Okay.
That's a factual truth, and that will lead to the gradual death of the station,
I don't think it's going there with authority,
believes that or not.
Well, I don't think it's going there. I do think those are perfectly legitimate criticisms. Ani, my partner, took 3 months off, and that was after being here for 14 years. And that has been, as I was saying about the trip to Africa, which is the first that I've heard about it, this is the sort of labor relations that we want to have and that we want to model for the community. WBAI is a sad case, but I want you to know that KBOO is in the black, and we're doing well because we have stuck to the original community.
WBAI was in the black for years, but the problems that flipped it and led to the avalanche disaster were all in place for years while it was still in the black. It's kind of like with nuclear or CO2 and many other things. The fallout of a problem doesn't appear until the problem accumulates for many years.
Well, and I appreciate your criticisms, but I was talking about more broad topics, and so I'm sorry that sorry to talk over you, but I do require dialogue. Also, we've gone way off topic. I don't want to act as a censor for criticism of KBOO directly, but that wasn't the topic of my show, so I'll just go on with that, and thank you very much for your call. And also, just by way of defense, I want to say the station actually is doing quite well. Dynamism in terms of participation is increasing, not decreasing at the station. We are in the black, and as I was going to say, I think that the reason we are in the black at this point and the reason that we're moving forward well is because we have stuck to our mission. We have not fallen for the continual pressure from the society generally to kowtow to capitalist interests. We have not taken the path, as so many failed stations have done across the nation, of attempting to get large donations from corporate contributors. The problem with them is that you may be able to find one or two or three that's excited one year, but they'll drop their support a couple of years later, if that long, and then you'll be left in the lurch and in debt. We are not in debt. We're doing well. Now I'd like to invite your comments or questions, 503-231-8187. KBOO politics are, of course, interesting, but I want to talk about Ebola. I want to talk about how it is affected by laissez-faire capitalism. I want to talk about climate change, and I want to talk about war. We have this ridiculous situation in which Army Lieutenant General Bill Mayville is telling reporters that he wants to think of the war against ISIS in terms of years. Now, this is the nation. This is what this is the grandkids and great grandkids of the nation that, with the Soviet Union, defeated Hitler and Tojo, and did that in just a few years with Britain. And I mean, even Britain's end of the war only lasted from 39 to 45, and so we're supposed to believe that we're just supposed to send our grandkids off to war with Syria because they're going to tell us right now that we're going to be in this for years. Well, this has to stop. And we do have anti-war coalitions building. Bill Mayville said, "Last night's strikes are the beginning of a credible and sustainable persistent campaign to degrade and ultimately destroy ISIS. I would think of it in terms of years," he added about the length of the expected campaign against ISIS. Mayville, who's the director of operations for Joint Chiefs of Staff, cautioned that ISIS fighters would adapt to the strikes in an attempt to melt into urban areas where the strikes can become less effective without ground troops. "We have seen evidence that they're already doing that," he said. We've seen that now as a result of the air campaign thus far in Iraq. We have to stop this. When the U.S. bombs people, as I've said many times on the air, there's no such thing as a surgical strike. Your surgeon doesn't remove gallbladder by throwing M80 firecrackers at it. And when you drop bombs on cities, it blows people up, blows up families, blows up toddlers, and it's murder. It's no less murder because someone did it in a nice air-conditioned aircraft from 30,000 feet. Anyway, the number to call, 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. Richard's on the air.
Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning.
As the researcher among us, I have another research question. Last Friday, I asked you to research the National Liberty Alliance and the OregonGrandJury.org. But today, in regard to climate change, I've heard a scurrilous rumor that President Al Gore has bought a mansion on the coast. And I think that as an indication of where we're at, it might be good to research the elevation of his holdings, or at least the house, the place where he's living.
And what's the point?
Can I entrust you with that research project?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, could you tell me what, why would I care that he, I mean, he's a rich man, former vice president, and should have been president to Al Gore, bought a house. What have you found out?
Well, you mentioned that the sea levels have risen 8 inches over the last few years, and they're rising, 13 tenths of an inch per year. If he's bought a place that he's residing in, that he intends to make a home out of, and that's the only thing. If he's not going to make a home out of it, maybe he bought it, I don't know, for a tax loss or something.
Oh, I think I see where you're going with this. If he'd bought it right on the beach, then maybe it would be for growing seaweed. But if he bought it up a bit of elevation, then he's predicting and hoping to escape.
That's kind of where I'm going.
Sea level rise. Yeah. Okay, I see where you're going with that.
Yeah, that's the only reason, just the obvious one. And I just thought it would be interesting. And I know you're so much better than a lot of us at punching in the keys and finding things in an expeditious manner. So I just wondered if you'd be doing that research for us.
Thanks for that. All right, number to call with your comments or questions, 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187, and Leslie's on the air.
Hey, good morning, Teresa.
Good morning.
Just got paid, decided I want to contribute to Partners in Health. This is regarding Ebola. I've done some research on them, and they seem to be pretty credible. In terms of the troops being sent to West Africa right now, I really send all my hopes out to Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. I would never wish, in addition to Ebola, for them to have to deal with Blackwater, XE, whatever the hell they're called now, and khaki. But I find it very interesting that Obama's going on about how wonderful our troops are. They're the best engineers in the world. They're the best at construction in the world. Hospitals, wow, it wasn't like that in Iraq. Why did we send Blackwater? Why did we send khaki? Why did we send all these contractors? I guess Eric Prince doesn't want to expose his boys to Ebola, but it's okay if the U.S. troops are exposed to it since they're basically paid at minimum wage.
Ooh, good point. All right, yeah, I mean, that article on Stripes.com, I think, is telling. Here's a little bit more of what the Major General said. Daryl Williams stressed in the town hall meeting that the troops would be at an extremely low risk of getting the virus because they would not be providing direct care to Ebola patients. And then they say, Ebola is transmitted via direct contact through broken skin or mucous membranes with the blood secretions, organs, or other bodily fluids of infected people and with contaminated surfaces and materials, according to the World Health Organization. The reality, Williams said, is that malaria poses a much greater risk for the troops. Okay.
Exactly.
And
hepatitis.
Yeah, I mean, they will get malaria, but the idea that they won't get Ebola, I think, is pretty absurd. There were hospital ships. The U.S. has access to hospital ships, and they have not been made available as they should have been months ago. And when you ask the military about that, they say, oh, there's a terrible risk. If we let one person on, the whole ship could become infected. Now, and I've been asking people to contrast that with statements like, Ebola is only spread through broken skin, mucous membranes. obviously, this isn't the case. Or if that's the case, then that transmission through mucous membranes or whatever is much more easily accomplished than we're being led to believe. I remember the discoverer of Ebola virus near the Ebola River in 1976 was recently contacted about this, and he said, oh, he would be okay sitting next to someone on the subway who had Ebola. So this is... This was used, I think, this disinformation, I think, was used to delay the response. And I've said before that I do believe someone somewhere who has some power in or around the administration and the Pentagon is pretty happy that a population-destroying virus has appeared in Africa. That's a really ugly thing to say, but I think it's a really ugly thing to do, and I think it's being done.
Yeah, I can totally see that.
Well, thanks for your call. Number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. And what I said should not be used to slur the, millions of good-willed people who would never do any such thing. All it takes, though, is some, let's say, Kissinger's, and there's a reason I say Kissinger, and I invite you to look that up. Depopulation, Kissinger, use a search engine. And as I was saying, the number to call 503-231-8187, and Daniel's on the air.
Hello there.
Hi there.
Our company provides consulting services and design and build engineering services for the World Bank, the International Renewable Energy Agency, and some countries in the South Pacific. So I would just like to briefly comment on where I see international aid money being spent on the climate change issue and what that tells you about is kind of the most likely outcome of climate change policy.
All right.
How things are playing out right now. So most of the money that is spent by the United Nations Development Fund and international aid agencies is spent, you can spend it on mitigation, that is to reduce CO2 emissions, or adaptation in order to help people cope with the climate change and sea level rise. About two-thirds or greater of the money goes to adaptation. And I think that's important when we're looking at the protests right now, because obviously there's a moral imperative to not flood and harm so many people, for example, in Bangladesh and other low-lying places, including several Pacific Island countries, will be completely wiped out when sea level rise occurs.
And Florida, so, yeah, go ahead.
So obviously there are moral issues that override economic issues. But I wanted to speak to the economic issues today because you have to run the numbers and kind of look at the investment and the expected outcomes of making investment on mitigation.
Before you go ahead, am I understanding from what you said that you're with the International Renewable Energy Agency?
We're a Oregon-based company that provides chemical engineering consulting services previously to the World Bank, and have active projects in proposal right now.
So you're not with IRENA, you're working with a company that is associated?
No, we're an outside consultant to international aid banks and renewable energy.
Gotcha.
For example, IRENA.
Go ahead.
National Renewable Energy Agency. We're an Oregon-based company.
All right, then.
And we have a track record of installing renewable energy projects in the South Pacific. The one thing that has to be looked at is the economic harm that will occur when climate change really sets in. In other words, everyone acknowledges that if we stop the emissions of carbon right now, the global rise in temperature would be about 2 degrees Celsius. So the debate is, what can we do to limit the damage to only 2 degrees Celsius? And so negative outcomes are going to occur no matter what, like sea level rise and climate change and
true that.
Habitat.
We're already there. Yes.
Right. So the spending money on adaptation, when does have to be compared to the negative impact the negative economic impact of the dislocation in terms of people forced to move and areas where crops are grown now and they're not going to be viable in the future, how it's going to really play out economically
under capitalism, assuming that capitalism isn't changed. But go ahead.
Well, you have to run the numbers no matter what. It's a cost. It doesn't, whether it's a public good or a private, cost or some, capitalism versus, some kind of collective way of measuring it, it's still a cost.
All right.
And so it is worth pointing out a couple of things. One is that some parts of the world will benefit from climate change. For example, areas in Canada and Russia will become viable for food production, whereas they are not today. The problem is that all the people that are going to be harmed are in the tropics, and they're not going to be immigrating to Russia, I can assure you. But there are some offsetting gains. They're trivial compared to losses, but they're not nothing. The other thing that's worth noting is that the economic costs are largely in the future, and so when you run a number like that, you look at a future cost, and then you run the net present value of that future cost. And there's a current, if you want to mitigate carbon emissions, you have a current cost in order to do it. For example, you have to spend money on renewable energy, or you're going to keep the oil in the ground and therefore opt for some form of energy which is more costly than just pumping it out of the ground and burning it. So I just want to take note of the fact that when the money is spent on adaptation, largely, it is a little bit of a tacit acknowledgement that it's going to happen.
Oh, yes. As I was saying at the beginning of this program, the insurance companies have met at the White House with the insurance, I can't remember the name of the association, saying they are calling for more robust building codes, for example, to cut their losses because of buildings being destroyed by storms. So go ahead.
Yeah. Well, so when you get down to personal decision making, you know, I feel pretty fortunate that we can claim that we're trying to solve the problem, but that's not practical for most people. And so adaptation really is the thing that has to be addressed for everybody because of, you know, first of all, there's a lot more stresses on society than just climate change. You know, we've got a demographic problem, a currency problem, a debt problem, a tropical diseases, a pandemic flu potentials. There's a lot of stressors on society, of which global warming is just one. And the cost in order to mitigate, which what everyone is protesting about, very rightfully wants us to reset how we handle carbon in our economy, is it's also a cost, and it's also a stressor in order to mitigate.
Okay, it is a cost, and you're talking about adaptation, and I'm going to have to ask you to wrap it up because I'd like to take one more call before the top of the hour. So summary.
I just want to point out that there are offsetting costs and uncertain economic gains from mitigation of carbon. I still think it's the right thing to do, and we're working on it. We're devoted to that. But it's not an obvious win when you look at the future economic harms and the difference that you could potentially impact versus the present cost. And that's why the money's mostly being spent on adaptation.
All right, I hear that. Thank you very much for your call. Number to call, 503-231-8187. I think I got time for one more call. And, oh, look, Pear's on the air. Hi, Pear.
Hey, good morning, Teresa. Let me tell you something about WBAI, why they're going broke.
All right.
For one thing, they did have very expensive offices on Wall Street. Cost them a lot of money. They were able to leave those premises and move to Brooklyn. They also have their antenna is on top of the Empire State Building. It's, I think they heard $50,000 a month, but I'm not sure about that. But it costs a lot of money, and they've got a lease. I think it goes until 2020, and they can't get out of that. So they've been inflating their expenses. Now, as far as their programming goes, I don't know about that, but they've had a lot of, fighting going on at the station. But those two things, the Wall Street offices and the Empire State Building antenna, really contributed to their going broke. So I just thought I'd pass that on.
All right. Thanks for that.
Should be a lesson for KBOO.
It should, yes.
Okay.
And as a matter of fact, KBOO owns their own building here.
That's true.
And it has for years, and it's one reason why we're doing well. I think one of the main reasons we're doing well is we've stayed transparent and we've stayed democratically dynamic. And you can become a member, a voting member, and a participating member by pulling up KBOO.fm and clicking the tip jar to join KBOO. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. Coming up at 10 o'clock, it's going to be Chris Andre with Air Cascadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary. 10:15, Flashpoints. 11 o'clock, Between the Covers, more. Here on your people-supported radio station, KBOO. And you've been listening to us on 90.7 FM in Portland, other frequencies elsewhere, and on the World Wide Web to all the ships at sea.
Yes, it is KBOO Portland with a minute now before 10 o'clock. Coming up in 15 minutes, join us for Flashpoints. Today, investigative reporter Matthew Lee and law professor Francis Boyle discuss the war in Syria and the role of the UN. At 11, Between the Covers welcomes Portland-based poet Kate Gray to discuss her debut novel, Carry the Sky, published by local Forest Avenue Press. And at 11:30, it's The Film Show with Jen Chavez and SW Concer. Coming up next, Chris Andre and Air Cascadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary. Coming up.
Join us for our monthly movie event, KBOO at the Clinton. This month, on October 9th, KBOO will host a screening of The U.S. vs. John Lennon, a 2006 documentary film about John Lennon and his transformation from Beatle to anti-war activist and the repression he faced because of his political activities. That's KBOO at the Clinton with The U.S. vs. John Lennon on Thursday, October 9th at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.